Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Okay.
What a weird day.
Do you want to describe your weird day to the audience?
The first half of the day was spent driving somebody around for 6 hours. But then I got home and I did some stuff and I went to go drop some stuff in the mailbox, and I found two adorable little puppy dogs running around outside my house, and I captured them, and I went looking for their owners, and I was unable to find them, and then I put them in my backyard and posted photos of them on the internet, and then I walked around the neighborhoods taping signs up saying, "Are these your adorable little dogs? Because it seems like somebody would want these dogs. They're kind of great," and nobody has claimed them thus far. So we all had dinner, and we all watched Jackie Brown together and hung out on the couch. And now they're sitting outside the door of my office right now, and hopefully they don't get, like, whiny because they don't have any friends keeping them company while I'm in here.
Oh, is Amanda abdicating responsibility?
She's getting ready for bed, the puppies have been restricted to a smaller area of the home since they're new and unfamiliar, and they seem housebroken and very comfortable snoozing on pillows on couches. So they're clearly not, like, you know, street dogs or something, but they don't have free rein of the house just yet.
Do they get along okay with PD?
Yeah, I mean, they were kept separate for a little while. Pete was just staring at him at the back door and whining, and then they were whining because they could hear him, and they were being whiny puggles together. But then they met and they hung out and they chased each other around a little bit. It's weird because there's, like, you've got, like, the small, medium, and large dog, and Pete's, like, the middle one. If you squish Pete down a little bit and, like, squish his face in a little bit, that's the little one. And then if you make him, like, 1.4x size and a little more beagle-y looking, that's the other one. So he's kind of, like, he's the grande puppy.
The grande puppy.
Yeah. So they've all been getting along pretty well now. Pete's just annoyed that he's not getting a walk because everything got a little busy and we ran out of time to give him a walk. So, you know, they're just hanging out, just kicking it.
Okay.
They have a little bit of like separation anxiety anytime we, like, leave them for a little while.
Well, it's a shame that you have found these dogs and they have no identification.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if they have microchips either, but I'll probably take the little short squat guy, which we have nicknamed Nugget. I'll take him to the vet tomorrow to see if he has a chip in him and if we can track down the owner.
Okay.
We nicknamed them Nugget and Beagle Bagel.
Nugget and Beagle Bagel, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be a good cartoon show. You could watch Nugget and Beagle Bagel.
Yeah, we tried to come up with a couple of different nicknames for him, but those are the ones that have stuck so far. I keep calling Nugget a little squat guy, and Amanda said I gotta stop calling him a little squat guy.
Yeah, that's not, like, if he knew what you were referring to him as, he might not think that you were saying very body positive things about him.
He very much likes me. He just keeps, like, standing on my chest on the couch and then, like, rolling over, just putting his belly in my face, and he licked my nose a minute ago too. He very much likes me.
That's
Nugget is my homeboy, and Beagle Bagel is a little bit more Amanda's homeboy right now.
Oh. Well, don't get too attached, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they're nice dogs, but hopefully they have some loving owners within an approximate quarter mile radius of here, because this dog has very small legs. Like, I have no idea how it managed to get all the way over to our neighborhood without, like, passing out of heat exhaustion, even though it was like 73 today or something.
Well, maybe somebody smuggled them into the country on a flight from Mexico, and then they got out of the Billingsley bag.
Nugget would probably fit in a bag on an airplane. He's very short, but I don't think Beagle Bagel would fit in a bag.
Okay. Well, I tried.
Maybe Nugget could fit in a backpack on top of Beagle Bagel.
Yeah, that makes sense. You get your carry-on and your personal item. That's two. There you go.
Well, in my scenario, I was thinking that maybe Beagle Bagel was a flight attendant-style dog.
I'm confused. Is that a dog dressed as a flight attendant?
Yes, he brings people peanuts and things. And he smuggled Little Nugget in from Mexico.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Makes perfect sense. But that wouldn't surprise me that they would be involved in some illegal shenanigans. Speaking of, there happens to be a movie that coincidentally has something to do with flight attendants and smuggling things. And that is Jackie Brown. A couple weeks ago, we did the whole thing with an Elmore Leonard novel called a thing that I'm forgetting.
Pretty sure it was called Get Shorty.
Yes, that was the one. And Get Shorty made...
Did you completely forget that movie already?
It has been so long ago, and I have had such a frantic couple of weeks that I unfortunately may have forgotten some things about Get Shorty. But
was it pre-vacation? It was pre-vacation, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then the vacation and the illness and...
The illness.
And a massive amount of work. Everything's been fantastic. But
That's how they get you.
Yeah, it's very, very nice of everything to happen all at one time. But the fun part is that you suggested that we do other movies adapted from Elmore Leonard novels. And I said, like, what? And you said Jackie
Brown.
These other
well-known movies that you've never heard of.
Yeah, I had heard of Jackie Brown. And I had heard of Out of Sight. I had not seen either one of them. You convinced me that we should do both of them as a Elmore Leonard salute
trilogy.
To Elmore Leonard month or something.
But, in memoriam, I have no idea if he's actually dead or not.
You should probably look that up before you say that about somebody.
He is dead. He died in 2013, 87 years of age.
Oh, okay. So
I feel like I knew this subconsciously. It's just my brain is not firing on all cylinders. Oh, he was in the Navy. Look at that.
Good for him.
43 to 46. Oh, well. 43 to 46. So.
Well, a lot of people were in the Navy.
Yeah, a lot of people were in the services in that particular period of time. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting.
So, this is, of course, your pulpy noir kind of-ish thing, except this has a very different vibe because it is a Quentin Tarantino movie, and this is one of the only Quentin Tarantino movie that is adaptation of somebody else's work rather than a postmodern accumulation of ideas that he has about other movies that he regurgitates into a new movie.
Yeah, he didn't take 30 different movies from 60 years ago and mash them together with some pulp novels or graphic novels or something. He just actually took a book and then spewed his Quentin Tarantino words all over the characters and made this movie, which by the way also came out exactly a year after Get Shorty. So the other reason we're doing this is in chronological order. You got Get Shorty in 96, Jackie Brown 97, Out of Sight 98, and they are all very different movies for only being 1 year apart. Although I mean, even if Quentin Tarantino made the exact same like script as somebody else and just did his Quentin Tarantino-ness to it, it wouldn't look anything like the other movie because he's a weird guy with weird tastes and does weird stuff.
You don't say. Now, I don't...
you want to bring up the feet now or you want to bring up the feet later?
I was gonna save that moment for when we...
You were going to work your way up to the feet or work your way down to the feet?
No, but the... I'm not a huge fan, and we've discussed that before when we've done Quentin Tarantino movies on this podcast. He has a lot of stylistic quirks that I don't enjoy a lot of the times. Sometimes I think that he's very funny, or he has something witty in there, or there's a clever piece of editing or an observation about human nature. But then a lot of the times, it feels like I'm just watching a bunch of people who are talking like how Quentin Tarantino would talk if he had too much coffee and substances. And
that's just how he talks all the time.
Yeah. I mean, maybe sometimes he's sleepy. I don't know. But that just seems like a lot of what happens in Quentin Tarantino movies, and I don't particularly enjoy it. And he has an obsession with certain stylistic affects of films from the the 70s. And that is certainly in Jackie Brown. Now, I can't say exactly why I didn't watch Jackie Brown at the time. I just know I didn't go back to watch it later because I thought it wasn't as well reviewed or something. I don't remember the reason.
Well, it's another one of those things where, like, how do you really sell an Elmore Leonard story and then mix that with some Tarantino-ness? And, like, if you tried to cut together a trailer of this and you're like, Quentin Tarantino does this, it's a flight attendant in a mall, and you're like, what's it about now? I mean, maybe you just go see it on the merits of Sam Jackson's hair slash facial hair thing and Pam Grier, but yeah, it's a very, when you describe all the parts, it sounds very unusual, and it sounds, I don't know, like it is very like mid to late 90s, like the poster, my brain, just like everything about it just feels very mid to late 90s. And it's that's not necessarily a thing that is like super attractive in general, especially when you're talking about like crime stuff. But it's interesting, I think. I don't know. I like it. And I feel like when you're talking about Quentin Tarantino just like slathering his nonsense all over this movie, I feel like he doesn't show off in this movie as much as he could. And most of his showing off is really like first act stuff where people have these like disturbingly long soliloquies about absolutely nothing. And then, you know, there's a couple, you know, one or two like very, very capital C cinema camera move things going on. Even the opening credits, like the moving sidewalk stuff with Jackie Brown is very cool. But you're like, well, this is a little
much
self-indulgent and silly, yeah. And it's a little Tarantino, but yeah. You know, it's fine, you go with it. But I feel like after you really get into like the second and third act, like he's relatively subdued, and to the point that it's just like it's almost a bit perfunctory, aside from the fact that you of course have your sort of standard issue Tarantino, like you know, mixing and matching of you know, time, like you have like intercut stuff like that happens a couple hours later or earlier, even if it's just like a couple of seconds just to throw a line at you, and then you watch the same scene from multiple perspectives at different times. Like that's a very Tarantino thing, but it doesn't stick out in the way like it does in Pulp Fiction, where time is just like, who cares about linear time? This one is just sort of like giving you alternate perspectives for a reason. So I don't know, it feels a little restrained. I mean, the dialogue is very Tarantino, especially in the beginning, but it feels restrained to me. What do you think?
I don't think it's restrained. I don't know where you're coming from that.
Well,
what
in the third act feels like showy Tarantino-ness? Aside from the last shot in the movie, which is very showy Tarantino-ness.
Well, that, but I was also going to say there's just like some Tarantino weirdness, like that kiss that they do at the end, where it's like, I'm going to like Eskimo kiss you. Well, that's not the politically correct term to use. I'm sorry. I had parents who said that. It is, but they do the nose to nose tip thing and then just sort of move towards each other's mouths, kind of in a weird side angle thing. It's unfortunate.
It's a loving kiss. It's not a sexy kiss. They're older people, both you know, wrestling with age slash a relationship that's never going to be, sort of thing.
But it's shot clinically, not not lovingly. So I don't love that.
Well, I mean, does Tarantino do anything? This is I can't believe I'm asking this question on a podcast. Is Tarantino able to make things sexy?
I think he might think he's making something sexy.
You mean when somebody's rubbing a toe on the rim of a glass?
Yes, exactly that. I for the life of me, now that you've asked, I'm trying to reflect on all the Tarantino movies I've ever seen, and I can't think of anything that I found like sexy. Like
I think in a subjective way, or it is like making sexual stuff more casual, just sort of part of the conversation. But I wouldn't say he's really able to, I don't know, cinematically or directorially turn a scene into something other than just sort of clinical.
Yeah, it's very strange. And another example of the weirdness is when they're in that car ride back from where Odell was staying to the Bond office, and it takes like 10 million years to go from point A to point B. But they have a camera mounted inside the car, and it is bobbing and shaking and gate weaving and high jittering, motion blurring all over the place. And
well, he has to shoot on film, and this was only a $12 million budget.
But I don't think that that shot was good or worth it to have the two of them sitting in the car talking to each other.
There's also a shot that where they miss the pan mark. I don't know if you noticed that when is it? It's when Jackie Brown comes back to her apartment and she's listening to the voicemail message that Max left. And it pans from the front door to her in the bedroom where she hits play, and then pans back to the kitchen where you can just hear her making a drink, and then pans back to the bedroom again when she goes back in there. When she first walks to the bedroom, the camera guy like way over pans and like she flips the light on the bedroom. He's like, oh, nope, center frame should be over here. It's like, well, didn't have time for another take, or he just didn't care.
Oh, no, well, I'm not talking about mistakes when I was bringing up the car thing necessarily. I just meant it was just a showy thing that he didn't need to do.
You were saying bobbing and weaving and gate weaving.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it had technical flaws, but I just meant the fact that he felt compelled to mount a camera and do that was silly to me.
Well, and maybe part of the reason I'm saying restrained is because I'm looking at things, particularly in the beginning of the movie, when he's not doing his like showy like crane camera moves or whatever. There's a lot of static camera work, which it feels like it's against the grain, or it feels like something he was trying out to see if he could, you know, use that as contrast. And you know, some of these like these longer extended static shots I think are sort of an experiment in that same way, where I don't mind the holding of things, like in the car scene with those two, or the last shot in the film. The ones that I do mind are the like awkwardly framed static three shot of Sam Jackson and De Niro on the couch, and then
Melanie
Bridget Fonda sitting on the little chair over there, where the camera's just like a foot off the ground with like a coffee table in the foreground, and then they're just like there, and it's like what is this frame? It's like so like claustrophobic that it feels like it was shot on 4x3 or something.
I wonder how much of that just had to do with shooting in that tiny apartment, but
I think it really did. But because shooting like an actual environment rather than building a soundstage, because either you don't have time or you don't have the money or you just don't feel like it. But it felt really awkward, especially if you have a giant film camera, probably contributed to it. But like, am I wrong that like there's a lot of scenes that take place in that stupid little apartment, and they were all framed very just like, well, this is the only place that the camera can fit.
That is kind of what it felt like. And this is shot by cinematographer Guillermo Navarro. And this is the first time, and I think only time, that Tarantino and Guillermo worked together. Because he did Robert Rodriguez's stuff prior to this.
Oh, Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. The old one.
He apparently,
I am number four.
Apparently was good friends, I guess, with Guillermo del Toro. So Guillermo's
Labyrinth is on there.
Guillermo'd it up. Also Spy Kids and Stuart Little, but
Guillermo's got to stick together. Oh, Four Rooms. Okay, he was the DP on the Misbehaviors segment, which was the Robert Rodriguez one, if I remember correctly.
Probably.
Desperado, Dust Till Dawn. Oh yeah, look at that. Spawn. Spawn had cinematography, right?
When it wasn't a scene animated and rendered in Max.
Actually, you know what? I'm gonna ease off of Guillermo here. I'm gonna blame Tarantino for framing, because he's a control freak nut job. So I blame him for all of the framing weirdness.
Okay. Well, I mean, that makes I have to assume that he was calling the shots on at least a few of the shots that were happening in that apartment. Speaking of, the beginning of this has that weird shot that takes forever, where we're going through the credits and Pam Grier has to stand there stoically the entire time. And then she has to run for the plane, hop on board. And then we don't see Pam Grier for a while. And we're left kind of wondering what that was about, because we go to Sam Jackson's apartment. Well, actually, we cut from that to a 4x3 CRT television, sort of self-pillar boxed into this format. of ladies in bikinis firing automatic weapons, and it's some sort of video service promoting these guns. And then we reveal that Sam Jackson is telling De Niro in very Tarantino dialogue all about how he sells guns and the kinds of guns and which guns are worth it and which guns aren't. Mm-hmm. And there is the hint that there is another human being there, in that we see somebody's legs move when Sam Jackson asks for a drink. And then we come to find out more about her later, and that's Mel, that's Bridget Fonda's character. And she's
whom I hate.
I know,
probably for a reason.
Yeah, you're not supposed to like her. but there is just something so unbelievably, like, I can't fathom why any of these people would have been together is the weird part. Because De Niro seems like he doesn't know what the planet Earth is like. And because they established that he just got out of prison, but he seems to be, like, I don't know, very aloof and detached and uncertain and
he's
like
stoned.
Unmoored. Well, but he in all of his other scenes, he's also just seems to not really understand what's going on. But he's
well, what do you expect after 4 years in prison, man? He's lost his edge a little bit.
Yeah. So anyway, there's a call, and it's about Beaumont, and so he's got to go get a bail bond, and this is where
By the way, when I was saying earlier that what would the trailer for this really look like, the one quote that I remember from the trailer, which of course lived on after this movie in most people's mind when they were a teenager at this age, was the AK-47 quote from the video, if you recall.
I don't.
When you absolutely positively have to kill every mother effer in the room except no substitutes. I think they led with that in the trailer.
Okay, I mean, I believe you. We should probably also address the use of language in this film.
There's a lot of it.
Yes, so much language. There is a, I believe somebody counted on the internet, there's like 38 uses of MF-er, and there's 38 uses of the N-word, and apparently Spike Lee objected to that, and Sam Jackson told him not to object to that, and there was a disagreement.
Yeah, I mean, if you're familiar with Tarantino movies and the way he works at all, this goes without saying, but he's a big fan of Sam Jackson, and the way he sort of works with him is, you know, he lets kind of Sam kind of do what he wants to do, and use his own words and make the character his own. I mean, like, the hair was his idea, apparently. So he's very open to letting Sam Jackson be the character he wants to be. So I think he kind of took the lead on a lot of that stuff. And yeah, I mean, obviously Tarantino's the director, but
there were other instances of this written in there, but
I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure. But you know,
yeah,
you put Sam Jackson in these movies to be this guy. Like, that's the reason that character is there.
Yeah, no, I I'm not going to take a moral stance on the specifics of this debate, but I will say that it is a little strange that number and frequency of times that characters use these words in here.
I mean, honestly, is it any worse, or is it unexpected compared to any other Tarantino movies?
Not that it's unexpected, but just that it feels jarring because it's not, it doesn't feel real to me to hear the frequency of it. Now, I'm not myself someone who finds himself in the situations in this movie.
You don't hang out with these types of people in these types of places?
No, it is entirely possible that whatever the real life De Niro and Odell are like, that they would use such colorful language with this frequency. But
His name is Ordell somehow.
Ordell, yeah, okay. So anyway,
Odell sounds like a better name than Ordell,
the farmer in the Odell. But they get the call, they go to the bail bond guy, Sam Jackson does his whole, you know, Tarantino spiel of saying his thing that way.
There are so many Tarantino spiels, whether it's like unnecessary monologuing about who I am, what I believe in, what I want to do, or like like trying to cleverly monologue about what the plot is, and like all of Melanie's stuff is just like flat out exposition, but she's like trying to be Tarantino surfer gal, and it's just like, well, you don't really pull it off as well as Sam Jackson did when he's monologuing, but sure, whatever, I guess we need this.
Yeah, and then you get the interaction with Max Cherry where he talks about putting up the bond, and they go back and forth over it being cash, etc.
I did not remember him being as sort of like straightforward, down to business, because most of the times that I've seen this movie, I've seen like the end half or third, but he's very much just, you know, like a, you know, straight to the point. I'm a bail bondsman. I'm not going to take any of your crap. Just like, just the facts, man. Like, give me your money and I'll take care of this stuff. And he's not really into Sam Jackson's flowery speeches.
Yeah, he's very, like, I don't know, dragnet cop about it.
Yeah, but he does have like a retired cop vibe, although he's not technically that, as far as we're aware, right?
No, he does make a comment about how he was going to go to a bar where a bunch of off-duty cops hang out later on. Mm. But so I don't know if he was or used to be or anything, and he seems to also have a knowledge of the trade. But
yeah,
that might just be
just like private eye guy who wants to like hang out with the cops.
Could be. But anyway, by now you're probably like, where's Pam Grier? And
we're not there yet. He sells illegal weapons that he brings in from wherever. One of his guys got arrested for doing some dumb crap, and they're trying to like use that as leverage against him, and the fact that he's on probation from a weapons charge previously, to get him to roll over on whoever he's working for, which we know to be Sam Jackson. And Sam Jackson basically leads us to believe that he tells the bail bondsman, like, hey, I know, you know, the cops are screwing with my pal, and I gotta help him out. And you're like, well, this doesn't really line up with the gun-loving guy. Although, who knows? Maybe he's a gun-loving guy from Florida who has a heart of gold. And it turns out, no, he doesn't. He's just, he's getting his buddy out of jail on a bail bond because he's worried that he's going to roll over on him. So he basically guilts him by saying, I got you out of jail, you're home because I paid for it, now I need you to do me a favor, and I need you to hide in this trunk while I go sell some guns to these people in Koreatown, and I need you to pop out and rack this shotgun and scare them all so they know I mean business. And he eventually guilts him into it by saying, we'll go over to Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles afterwards and get some red beans and rice and stuff, and doesn't that sound delicious because you're high? But he puts him in the trunk and then drives around the corner in his car, and all in one very delightful looking crane shot, parks in this dirt lot, pops the trunk and shoots him twice. It's like, wow, okay. So he's killing his witness, so he can't roll over on him.
Yeah, but I did not like the way this scene was going initially.
Which part, the like 5-minute argument about getting in the trunk?
Yes. but here's the thing. I know why it's there. I was like, come on, get to the point. And then we got to the point, and I was like, finally.
Think it was like dancing a line between like, is he being honest? Is he screwing with him? Like, we're building tension. Like, what's going to happen? Like, does he have to do it? Does he feel obligated because he's being guilt tripped? Like, does he know he's going to get killed even though like he feels bad and he has to do it anyway? You didn't feel the tension there? You're just like, get on with it?
I did not explore that tension in my mind. No. but I do really like when he slams the trunk. And Chris Tucker snaps back at him about slamming it so hard on him. And then he gets into the front seat and he starts putting on his gloves. And they don't cut away or cut between each of the gloves going on. They make you watch the entire glove going on process. And
it's,
you
Tarantino,
know,
Tarantino, you got to revel in that. You got to just watch as he slowly, ruefully puts on his leather gloves before he drives away.
Yeah, you know what's going to happen. And
then he takes that really terrible tiny little pistol out of the glove box.
You are so obsessed with pistol size. I don't understand it. Every time there's a pistol on screen, you're always like, that one's so small, and it's like, I don't understand.
Well, it just looks funny. Like, if you're making a movie with guns, usually you pick one that looks cool. But Tarantino's all like about picking like weird, quirky guns.
Well, I mean, it's one that goes in the glove box, and it's not obviously one he was hoping to hold on to for the rest of his life, because he just goes around the corner and shoots him. And I do like the crane shot, because we have, before he puts on the gloves, he puts on some music, and the music that he puts on plays as the car goes away, and you hear it fade out, and then he goes around the corner and you hear it fade back up, as he gets into that like dirt lot that was on the other side of the fence. And he gets out and he opens it and he shoots Chris Tucker. And that really sells it. You know, that's how you know that it's not just another car that happened to pull into the dirt lot, because it's nighttime, so you can't see. But I liked how that all played out. It worked out really well. And it was a good use of the crane to do it, so that you could get a sense of this sort of weird, short, disorienting ride that Sam Jackson
put on. It was a nice use of cinematic film language to sort of tell the story.
Yeah. And Pam Grier gets off her flight and is going through the parking lot, and she's stopped by some guy and Michael Keaton. And they're very whatever your name is. He's very enthusiastic about stopping her, and they need to go through her bag, and she doesn't want to let him go through the bag. And he's like, oh, well, we'll just get a warrant. It'll make it take forever. And she's like, okay, fine, go through the bag. And sure enough, they find an envelope with $10,000 in it. And they know that you have to declare anything like that when you're coming through customs, and they want to know more about the situation, and they know about this from Beaumont, who we had just seen get shot, but who is apparently the source of the information for how Ordell was bringing his money in and why she was stopped and searched. Unfortunately for her, Michael Keaton finds a bag of, was it cocaine?
Yeah,
cocaine in the bottom of the manila envelope. And what I love is her reaction to that, because Pam Grier plays this so well. Like she knows what her rights are. She's very confident. She feels cool and collected in all of this. And then that baggie.
She's no snitch. She's not playing the cops game. She's not giving them anything.
No, she's very unlike Beaumont. But the second that bag comes out and he asks her, then it all just melts away. All of her confidence, everything is just gone. And she's like, where the bleep did that come from? And that lets you know as an audience that like she's actually seriously startled by this. And Sam Jackson pays a visit to Max Cherry to have his $10,000 moved off of Beaumont and onto her to get her out. And they have a little exchange about how weird it is that Beaumont died.
Oh, man, you didn't hear about that? Apparently he had an enemy and somebody shot him. It's like, dude. I feel like if you're a bail bondsman doing this sort of stuff, you should just have microphones in your office all the time.
There is a distinct lack of recording in this movie, but
notably
at the mall.
All of the department store stuff, yeah. Like this is apparently the era before there were thousands of cameras all over the place, which it's good because Pam Grier does a great job of like selling her emotional distress with her acting to the cash register lady. But, you know, if there were cameras there, they would be like, oh, there's Max Cherry, so we'll go get him now.
Mm. But skipping back, Pam Grier gets out. Oh, no, there's a sentencing hearing thing where we have the courtroom, and there is a split diopter shot of the judge and Pam Grier in the, like, I don't know, conviction box. It was like a jury box, but they put all the people who were there for the hearing just in the box.
Yeah, it's a thing.
Yeah,
don't spend a lot of time in criminal court, but that's a thing.
Oh, okay. Well, I've only served jury duty a few times. But the judge, you know, he's like whatever about it. And the public defender is Denise Crosby. And if you are familiar with who Denise Crosby is, she was Tasha Yar in Star Trek The Next Generation. And then she didn't
say, is she a Star Trek?
Yeah, and then she didn't like being on the show, so she was killed off during the first season. Not even like in between seasons, during the first season. Yeah. And then she realized that she actually liked being on the show once they changed producers and got their crap together, and so she wanted it back on.
Did she come back as a clone or a twin or something?
It's even better, Dad. So there is a time rift, and an old version of the Enterprise C, comes out of the time rift, and it changes the timeline, and all of a sudden, Tasha Yar never died, and it's crazy, because they're at war with the Klingons, and all this bad stuff has happened.
Because they can do that, because they can just like go back in time, and it makes no big difference to the storyline, because nothing ever happens on Star Trek.
Well, see, here's the thing, though, is they know that this ship needs to go back to its time so that they can reset this timeline.
Because there's two of them.
No, because this is the old. This is before the Enterprise D. It's the Enterprise C, the one before it blew up. So they need to go make it blow up. But they got to send it back through, and Tasha Yar decides to go back through because she knows that she's dead in the other timeline. Unfortunately, she goes through.
She does a Close Encounters, like a Take Me With You thing.
Yeah. She goes. It through the thingy, and so we're like, oh well, that was nice having Tasha Yar on that one episode, whatever, but cut to a little while later when all of a sudden there is Romulan Commander Sela, who happens to be a blonde Romulan that looks just like Denise Crosby, and we find out her backstory is that apparently her mother, who was Tasha Yar, was captured by Romulans and then had either voluntary or involuntary relations that produced the child, and then died while trying to escape with the child, and then the child grew up to be half Romulan, half human Commander Sela. And you're like, this is a really convoluted way to bring Denise Crosby back onto the show for a handful of episodes.
I hate when I become a Romulan by some convoluted family way.
No, you're the half Romulan, half human daughter of yourself.
That's not right.
No, it's very stupid. But anyway, I just had to point it out because it just entertains me whenever I see Denise Crosby like show up somewhere, like in the first episode of Dexter.
I don't even remember what she looked like, Denise Crosby here. Okay, it's this lady.
Yes. Anyway, she would be distinctive if you had watched Star Trek. Anyway, that's
Pet
not
Cemetery, the original one.
Yeah.
There she is. She's got a yellow outfit with her little yellow hair.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. She was in charge of security. But they do the courtroom.
Oh, look at these puffy shoulder pads. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was
what
the,
is this?
That was the Romulan style, it was enormous shoulder pads.
This is her half Romulan daughter of herself?
Yes. her half Romulan daughter of herself.
It's like when a kid like stuffs pillows inside like one of their parents' shirts that they're wearing to be like, I'm an adult now.
It looks even more ridiculous when you can see like the full body shots where they're like standing like in a room together, because then they just look like these like weird linebackers, but they're made out of like shoulder pads that are just foam, like not like, you know, linebackers with tiny little legs.
Come on, show me a full body Romulan.
Turn off safe search.
Whoa, what is this? Star Trek Next Generation. She's wearing some sort of like genie outfit with like a Superman curl glued to her forehead.
Oh, no, that was a real bad one. That was the one where some racism happened.
Some racism happened?
Yeah. Or it's the one where they all got drunk on space germs that get you drunk. And then
sick.
She had sex with Data.
You know what I just realized?
You should watch Star Trek The Next Generation?
No, Denise Crosby is one letter away from being the same name as my father-in-law.
Oh.
His name is Dennis.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for doxing him.
I didn't give you his address and his social security number.
That was a joke, Dan. But so anyway, the bond is acquired, Max Cherry goes to pick her up. A scene we did not see of Beaumont, but Max
dropping
Cherry
off and picking up, and there's a very weird fade to black in between the two, so he didn't have to try and figure out how to stitch the scenes together.
It was odd. I'm not sure why they didn't just have
also,
him.
Also, he's sitting on a folding chair outside the, like, gate of the prison, just, like, on the sidewalk. And you can just see Tarantino, like, okay, you're going to have your back to her, and she's walking up from the distance, and it'll be this very long shot, and then you'll slowly turn around, and you'll see her in the distance, and we'll get closer to your face, and it'll be a very dramatic reveal. And he's like, nobody thought to say, like, why am I sitting in a chair outside the gate of the prison with my back to the gate reading a newspaper? Or no, he's got a novel. He's got a book with him.
Was it a folding chair or a bench?
I'm pretty sure it was a chair because it was just like arbitrarily like in the middle of the sidewalk. I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The important part is he is swooned. He is wooed by the appearance of Pam Grier walking out of the prison, and she's a little not put together from being in jail, understandably. And so she doesn't want to be seen anywhere or anything, because when he offers to get her a drink on the way to dropping her off, then she says someplace, you know, dark. And he says, oh, well, there's this cop place. And she's like, no thanks. And then he's like, well, what about the Hilton sports bar thing? And she's like, that doesn't sound dark. And he's like, well, what about the darkness? And she's like, because I just got out of prison and I look terrible and I don't want to be seen by anybody. And he's like, oh, okay.
It's like, Max, my dude, have you ever been around a woman in public?
Yeah, I mean, if I just got out of jail, I wouldn't be like, yeah, sure, take me to Champs. I don't know. What are they thinking? Let's hit
the Benihana. Let's go see some people to have a conversation.
Yeah, but then she says, you know, you're taking me to drop me off at my place anyways, so let's just go to a bar that's near there. And they do. And they get to chit-chatting about stuff. And it's a nice scene, and then he goes to drop her off at her place, and she takes the opportunity to confiscate a firearm from him.
Yeah, because you think it's going to be the same thing, because he drops her off, and you see across the street Ordell's just chilling there. He's got his gloves on. Well, he's got different gloves on now. He's got brown driving gloves or whatever, but he's got an even tinier pistol, and you know the deal, like. Witness that's potentially looking at years in jail. He's got to end her. And there's a very peculiar scene once he goes inside, where they're like having this tete-a-tete back and forth with like, oh, the
light
cops
switches
are questioning her. Yeah, it's one of those like those classic mid 90s halogen lamps that burned everyone's houses down, where you got that dimmer knob that makes the lamp make that horrible buzzing noise, and she keeps turning it up and he keeps turning it down and back and forth.
He turns it down to the point of it being off.
Yeah.
And she doesn't react to him doing that, which is very weird, because you would think, well, since there's no other lighting, she would say something.
She knows he's making it dark so he can kill her easily, but she's not terribly concerned because she has a gun.
Yeah, although she's very confident about her ability to defend herself in close quarters over this.
Hell yeah. She's paying her. Don't take no crap.
Well, but she does a really good job, because they get to that part where it's dark silhouette against the mini blinds, and he's got his hand around her throat, and he's asking her all these questions about what the police know about him, and you just hear this tiny little click, and he asks if that is a gun against his privates, and she says...
This is one of the handful of Tarantino, like, arbitrary time cut things. Because right before you hear that click, you see like two quick shots of Max Cherry going to do something and opening the glove box and seeing the gun is missing. Like, you could have waited to do that till afterward, where she did the gun thing to Sam. You could have been like, where the hell did she get that gun? Or maybe we didn't even need to know. Well, I guess we needed to know, because that's why he shows back up the next day. But like, we didn't need like 3 seconds of Max Cherry in the middle of this other scene. It was a little disjointed.
It was weird. But I like how she turns the tables on him and gets his gun and then holds both the guns in the back of his head, and then they go sit down and then they talk about the plan and stuff. And it's interesting how she is completely taken ownership and control of the situation from this gun smuggling evil murdering guy who was going to kill her.
Yeah.
And she has this whole thing worked out where they're going to bring in the rest of the money by getting her reinstated back as a stewardess because she's apparently been calling in sick this entire time. And
yeah, she knows the deal. She knows that if she is not, she's no longer useful to Ordell because the ATF is watching her, and she's not really useful to the ATF because she's not saying anything, that, you know, she's probably going to get killed by Ordell because she's just a loose end. But she figures that out before he even gets there, and figures out a way to manipulate the cops primarily at this point in the plot, such that she can continue to at least appear to work for them and appear to be acting in good faith, trying to give them Ordell, but also sort of like do it in such a way that they don't end up catching him, and they think that she did a good job, so they kind of like let her off, and then everyone can go back about their business and go their separate ways. And she has this nice line about how if she does get arrested and has to do her year in jail, which, you know, she was trying to feel out Max Cherry about how much time she might actually be looking at. If she has to do a year in jail, Ordell's going to pay her $100,000. Basically, that's her compensation for bringing in his $500,000 and keeping her mouth shut and everyone going about their business. So they're still sort of partners rather than her being just like a pawn in this and being expendable. She's kind of running the game with him now. So they're on the same level, even though she's not taking a big cut of money. She's just basically saying, I'm going to be loyal and you're going to pay for that. And here's why, because I'm going to help you and stuff. So she does a pretty good job of like gaining control of the situation, at least to the point that at this point in the story, they are collaborating. She is not fully stabbing everyone in the back.
Right. Well,
double, triple, quadruple crossing, whatever.
What I want to know is at what point she decided to turn the tables on literally everyone.
I feel like it probably wouldn't have been from the very beginning, because that's a little bit too Ocean's 11 or whatever. But by the time she started feeling out the ATF, because she had to go back to the ATF and give them this plan, like, I'm going to do the $10,000 the first time to see how it works, and you guys are going to take that, and then that's our dry run, and then the next time around we're going to do the big transfer of the funds. If they buy that, then she can sort of feel out how open to manipulation they are and sort of work the scenario on her own, because then at that point she's coming up with the plan about like where I'm gonna go and what I'm gonna do, and that's when she figures out that she can just show up a little bit early and pull a fast one on kind of everybody.
Yeah. And so she goes, has meetings with ATF guys and Max Cherry, and there's some back and forth, and I don't want to break down all of this stuff that starts happening
again,
in here.
Just like get shorty. This is a very like complicated up, down, left, right plot that goes in a lot of different directions that is almost impossible to remember, and it's not necessarily germane to understanding what happens. It all flows together just fine, but there's a lot of stuff there that you should probably just watch.
Yes, this is a real Konami code of a plot. And
this is the Elmore Leonardness of it. Like this is how his movies go. There's a lot of characters and a lot of pieces, and they go to different places, and you can never really remember exactly what order they did them in, but it all seemed to work at the time.
Yeah, and I don't have any complaints about like a piece that's out of place in this, but I'm just saying it would be useless to try to summarize this, especially since it's a 2.5 hour long movie.
Was the plan okay for you, though? Although at the end there, when there was like the double, triple, it wasn't even a quadruple, it was like a sextuplet, turns out, which was the lie that Max Cherry was trying to sell to Ordell. And by the time you get to that point, you're like, this is a little bit much with the story. But up until that point, I feel like the plot was reasonably complex, but not overly complex. What did you think?
Yes. Everything up until Max Cherry goes to talk to Ordell. I think when he goes to talk to Ordell, Ordell falls for this too easily. And also, Ordell enters a completely dark office without like turning on a light. But as we've seen earlier, he likes to turn off lights, so maybe this is fine for him. I don't know.
It's a little bit like, with as angry as he got at De Niro for not being immediately suspicious of seeing Max Cherry in the department store. He walks into a dark office and doesn't get suspicious immediately. So that's a little unusual. I mean, he had to know he was walking into something that she had probably fortified her position a little bit. She probably has a gun. Maybe she turned off some lights, so it was a little harder for him to see that she has a gun. But the fact that it's completely pitch black should have raised a little bit of suspicion. But
yeah, and in addition to that, he was also willing to walk towards somebody in the dark, not knowing their condition or who else was inside of the room.
Yeah, he had Max in front of him when they first came in as like a human shield, but then as soon as he hears Jackie's voice, he's like, "Oh, hey, that's my friend. I know her. I will go ahead now."
Yes, he seems to very quickly lose his anger and his self-protective qualities. I don't know exactly why that is, other than they wanted to have him get shot immediately.
Maybe it's just that like everything appears to be what they said it was going to be. She's there. The money's there. He wants his money. Like, okay, we finally made it and everything lines up properly. So let the guards down and give me my money, even though all of the lights are off.
Yeah. And, but the rest of the plot mechanics, I liked the dry run in the Del Amo Mall. I liked the first meeting in the Del Amo Mall. I like when, Max Cherry is coming out of a movie screening and you can see the poster for Hannibal behind him.
Oh, is that what that was?
I believe so. And I think that came out after this or the same year. Anyway, you ever see Hannibal?
That's one of the ones with the Lecter and he eats the people and stuff.
Yes. The way you say that makes me think you didn't see it.
No, I didn't see it, but it's, I'm just saying it's in that with that world because there's what like three or four movies that are in that storyline, right?
Yeah, I have only ever seen Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal. I haven't seen Red Dragon?
Yeah,
the one with Edward Norton.
Is that the one with Edward Norton? I thought one of them had Ralph Fiennes in it.
They might be in the same one because Ed Norton was was the FBI agent.
Oh, sure, that makes sense. Let's see. Yeah. Red Dragon 2002. Well, that looks like Anthony Hopkins there.
Well, he's Lecter.
Oh, and Ed Norton and Ray Fiennes. Okay, so wait, who's Ray Fiennes then? Francis Dolarhyde or something. I thought he was, I thought it was like a prequel Lecter.
Sort of, except they just have Anthony Hopkins playing himself again. So I don't know.
Is that Ed Norton's blonde?
Yeah. But anyway,
like
Hannibal's weird.
Shouldn't be blonde.
No. You ever want to see Ray Liotta at an interesting dinner scene?
Is it the one where he eats his own brain?
I think you say spoilers and then the thing so fast nobody could possibly fast forward through it.
It's a movie from 2001. I figure 18 years. Is...
Yes. Yeah, yeah. What I mainly remember about Hannibal was that I saw it in a movie theater by myself. You know when everybody was doing that like meme of what was the first movie you remember watching by yourself? The first one I remember watching by myself was Hannibal.
Yourself?
Yeah, I don't know why. And then I went down to the food court because I was hungry, and I went to Sparrow and I got one of those you know the double crust things where it's
they flip one over on top of the other one.
Well, it's not flipped, but it's like just the dough wraps the entire way around.
It's like two pizzas, one on top of the other, face down, but then they connect them.
Yeah, like the crust is sealed, so it's not like they took two pieces in front of you and put them together. They made this way. So anyway, it is full of meat, and sure enough, there's like the little gray sausage bits, and I'm looking at it and I'm going, Oh no, because it reminded me of something from an earlier scene.
I'm looking at this image here where Ray Liotta's got a hat on, and he's very pale, and Lecter is cooking something in a suit
Yeah,
over a little propane burner.
Yeah, I mean, Ray Liotta's pretty happy. But
do I recall that there's some very bad CGI to sell that effect? I feel like I've seen that scene and or shot.
I don't remember. I'm probably haven't seen that since I saw it in theater. And it was not a movie I wanted to revisit, oddly enough.
Did it traumatize you?
It's a little weird. There's the bad guy in it, who oddly enough is not Hannibal Lecter, but kind of is. They're one of his earlier victims. It's played by, what's his name? Why am I blanking his name? Commissioner Gordon guy from the Dark Knight stuff. And,
him. There's G in his name. Gary Oldman.
Yes, Gary Oldman. He's under a lot of makeup and for some reason wanted to do this as uncredited. I'm not sure why. But he's unsettling. Back to this movie. It was just interesting that you saw the poster there. But we go show the extent of the Del Amo fashion square mall thing and food court and... she's talking to Sam Jackson and talking to Mark Cherry, and Sam Jackson sees Mark Cherry, but doesn't really do anything about it. But they do an exchange here and they do the test run, and this lets the audience, as well as everybody in the movie, know how things are supposed to go. We see the tricky little handoff thing where the one girl is supposed to pick up the bag, but she picks up something else, and the woman at the table next to her picks up the other bag and then walks off with it, and Max Cherry tails that person while the ATF tails the first person, and the ATF is not supposed to catch the first person, so they don't know about the double hands off thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
you
Max
see that
knows.
There's a little bit more going on. Ordell's basically putting an extra layer of abstraction to try and make it a little sneakier and make sure his money gets out. And of course, Jackie confronts him about it, claiming that she saw the other girl, even though Max probably just told her about it. And they have a shouting match on the patio through a glass door about it.
Yeah, where you can hear everything they're shouting about. But it's interesting because Sam Jackson's trying to get control of the exchange, and Jackie's not going to let him have it.
And she does it well enough. Not only is she just angry, but she's just like, this is my butt on the line with these ATF people. Like, if you screw this up, they're going to look at me and go like, what the hell just happened? And I'm going to go to jail. So you need to let me handle this and or just be up front with what the hell is going on.
Mm-hmm. And so she meets with Ray, and they have an awkward meal. And
by the way, did you like Ray Nicolette in this movie? I can't wait for you to see him in the next movie.
I wish he dialed it back a little bit.
He's so much dumber in the next one. He's so dumb. So dumb.
And what I don't like is in this particular scene, he's wearing a leather jacket, and they had apparently set the mic somewhere directly next to the leather jacket, where you almost hear the leather jacket more clearly than his dialogue. It is interesting. Every time he moves, there's like a...
Mm-hmm. When he's like fast walking down the hallway on his way to the interrogation room?
No, just when they're sitting at the table.
Oh, yeah, that too.
But anyway, they have their little chit-chat and stuff, and so now you're starting to like piece together the layers of the betrayal that will occur. And we already know that Melanie was trying to turn Robert De Niro on Sam Jackson, and that De Niro told Sam Jackson about it, and that De Niro also had sex with Melanie, and that Melanie likes to show her feet. And these are all the facts about Melanie you really need to know. And she did a lot of drugs and went to Japan one time.
She roller skated.
Yes. Also, in a really creepy shot, De Niro picks up a photo off the TV, and it's like, oh, it's been like, what, 7 years? And oh, look, this photo of you. Like, how old were you in this photo? And she says, oh, 14. He's like, oh, I thought you were at least 16. It's like, why would you think that she's at least 16? That's a really creepy thing to say.
Well, he's an ex-con bank robber, so.
I know, but not everybody needs to be like a like creepy, like, dude out for stuff. It's weird.
Did you look at De Niro in this movie?
Fine. Anyway, it's especially bad towards the end when his hair is greased back and he's got that weird mustache, bad. The handlebar mustache.
Yeah, it's so bad when he greases it back.
But it's like he goes from disheveled to just like, ugh.
He's,
I don't know what's going on.
He's professionally like a scumbag now.
Yeah, and... But I like when they do the cross-cutting thing for the actual run for this, where they're going back to 3:30 and what everyone was walking through and doing, and they cut the different vantage points that those characters would have of the same situation. So it's an interesting way to compile the scene. You are left with the odd realization that you get a scene of Melanie after she's died, but it's... you know, not that big of a development. It wasn't like she was building character at that point. But we get the first run through where Melanie picks up the money, and that Pam Grier's put on the suit that she's had her eye on. She's frantic and she goes out and she pays, and she leaves the other bag and says that somebody left a bag with towels in it, and then she leaves in a frantic rush to the front. And so you're like, oh, maybe she had a change of heart. Maybe she changed her mind and she's leaving the money and she's going to start a new life with Max Cherry, and they're going to be on the up and up.
Is that what you actually thought? It's been so long since I saw this movie for the first time. I don't remember what I actually thought.
That was really literally what I thought. I'm usually pretty sharp about this kind of stuff. So
Tarantino, gotcha.
Yes. Tarantino got me. She goes to the thing and shouting, and then in runs all the ATF guys, and she says that Melanie stole the bag and she doesn't have it.
She really uses the best defense that she's had through this entire movie, which is just like, I'm a regular person, like, being a pawn for the ATF. Like, I'm not a cop, and you never really told me what I'm supposed to do in, like, all situations, and I'm not trained for this. So the plan went wrong, the money is gone, and what was I supposed to do other than come out here and start shouting your name? Like, you can't blame me for the fact that the money's gone, because literally what the hell was I supposed to do?
Yeah. And meanwhile, the other frame of reference, we get their late departure from the apartment because she's just in the bathroom doing whatever, and... then they arrive at the mall, and there's this struggle to get into the department store, and then how to go through the department store. And Mel is picking on De Niro this entire time, just like pecking at him constantly. And he's getting more and more agitated, and he's threatening violence, etc. And basically like dragging her through the store. And
he like actually finally... has a job to do for the first time in a very long time, and he's like super stressed out about it. Maybe he's got a little bit of the paranoia from all of the weed since he's been out of jail.
This is possible. And she goes into the fitting room, gets the thing, comes back out. They've got the thing. They're rowing through the parking lot, and she's like, "I don't even remember where we parked." Then he's insisting on carrying stuff, and there's more bickering and like, oh, do you want to try that thing? You think the car's over there now? And then he's had it up to here and just takes out his gun and shoots her once in the chest and once in the stomach, and then leaves her and goes to the car muttering to himself, and then starts the car, drives out a little, and then the car stalls, and then he starts it up again.
The best part of that is in reverse. It's just like the song starts for half a blip and then it stalls out and turns off.
Yeah. Oh, man. What? So strange. And then he gets out of there, and you're just like, well, that was weird that he just killed Melanie. I'm sure that puts a wrinkle in some of these plans, or all of these plans, but not in Pam's plans.
If anything, it helps her, because there's one less person to attest to what actually happened.
This is very true. Although I don't know how she could have possibly counted on that.
No.
But
you just counted on Melanie being obnoxious.
It's pretty dependable, I suppose.
You can't trust Melanie, but you can trust Melanie to always be Melanie.
That is a line in this movie.
It's true. It's what he says. It's mm-hmm. It's one of those things that makes sense when you hear it because it's just so true.
We get Max Cherry's point of view, and he's going to go to the mall, and for the first time we see his coworker and stuff. And so he goes to the mall, and he's waiting by the dress section, and some lady comes up and says something to him, and he's like, oh no, just waiting for my wife. And then the exchange occurs, and De Niro makes eye contact with him, and he gives him the little finger salute thing.
Yeah,
whatever it is.
I really like that from his perspective too, because when you're looking at it from De Niro's perspective, he looks over and he sees Max Cherry, and Max Cherry gives him the little like salute thing. You're like, why in the hell would he be there? Like, he's blowing his OPSEC by being there. And then you see Max Cherry's perspective where he's just like so engrossed in like watching this story unfold in front of him that he's not really paying attention. And then by the time he looks over at De Niro's just like locked on him, like, what the hell are you doing here? And he's like, oh, play it cool. Just give him a little salute, guy, and turn around and walk away.
Yeah. So when they get out of there, because Melanie has the money, then he goes up to the fitting room lady and says, oh, my wife left a bag with some paper towel, some beach towels in it. And the lady goes, oh, well, nobody's in the fitting room right now, so you can go back in there and get it. It's in the last stall.
She's too busy writing out the paper/carbon copy receipt for the suit, because apparently it's 1972 in this movie.
And so he goes back there, gets the bag, looks at it, examines it, and then walks out of there. And gets into the car on the roof and then drives off.
Yeah, and the whole time he's just looking around going like, am I going to get rushed by SWAT guys? No? Okay. I guess this all worked.
Yeah, he seems genuinely surprised. But he gets out of there with the money, and De Niro goes to pick up Sam Jackson, and Sam Jackson's like, where's Melanie? And De Niro explains that she was mouthing off, so he shot her twice and left her for dead.
And after a certain point, Sam Jackson's like, you know, if you had to do it, you had to do it, because, you know, he explained in the beginning, like, you got to be in this all the way, like, that I shot Beaumont because he was a liability, so if that's what had to be done, it had to be done, and I expect the same from you. But then he's like, you know, You had to. And then he looks in the bag and he's like, there's 40 grand here and a bunch of books. What the hell is, what does he say? Like, is Melanie in a hotel somewhere with $500,000 of my money right now?
Yeah, because Melanie's out there. So it looks suspicious. And he says, no, of course not. This is where he mentions that he saw Max Cherry there. And then
it's like, oh, Sam, I was wondering what he was doing there. I didn't think anything of it at the time. You didn't think anything of it at the time? Bail bondsman?
Sam Jackson's a little upset.
I mean, there's just enough, like, you know, I think they played it well enough that De Niro doesn't really hang out in Max Cherry's office very long. Like, he goes out to the car and listens to music instead of being in there for the bail bond. You know, play music as loud as you want, just don't touch my levels. So he doesn't really know the deal with Max Cherry, especially his connection to Jackie. So, like, it would be a little bit weird for him, but not in the same way that, like, Sam Jackson seeing him there would be, like, a total tip-off, because he knows that they're friendly in an awkward way because he saw them having lunch at the food court.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so Sam Jackson shoots De Niro, and De Niro gets a little what kind of thing, and then Sam Jackson leans over.
A lot of blood splatters all over the windshield.
it was one heck of a squib. And then Sam Jackson leans over and then pops him one in the chest to be extra sure. And then he gets out of there and walks away. And
I like how he casually like looks around to see, like, oh, can I make my subtle getaway? It's like, you should leave. There's blood all over the windows. If somebody saw you standing next to that car, they'd be like, that guy just killed somebody.
Fortunately, it's downtown Los Angeles, so he's pretty safe. But
I thought this took place in Huntington Beach or something. Oh, wait, what beach was it?
Well, it was
why did I feel like we were in Florida in that condo at some point?
Well, the condo's by the beach.
Yeah, but
that's But he says he's going to a bar downtown.
Yeah, that's right.
That's why there were all those buildings and stuff that were high rises and things.
There's mention of Compton in this, so it has to be. I guess they just totally like spaced on whatever that first title card was.
Yeah. So anyway,
apparently the strip club is on Olympic Boulevard.
Great.
Sam's Hofbräu Strip Club.
Is that really it?
That's what it says. The filming location.
That's really a thing?
Hofbräu Strip Club?
Oh God.
Let's see if it still exists. Do you think they have just like schnitzel and strippers?
I don't want to know.
Sam's Hofbräu
Google history, so
it's on Yelp.
Oh no.
It has 279 reviews. It has a 3.5 out of 5. So it's open till 2 a.m. You got time to get there.
No, thank you.
Let's see.
I'm okay. That's
Best spot
more than
in downtown. Money is always flowing in here, and the wings are bomb.
Oh well, this is a place for you then, Dan.
I do like chicken wings, but no, you don't eat food at a place like that.
No, you don't.
Oh, here's a 3-star review. I'm not gonna read it out loud without reading it on my own first.
Dan, please don't read any of it.
Oh,
this is
problematic review here.
Yeah, I would imagine. Please stop reading the page. Close it. Close the tab.
I like that the people that give it bad ratings also check in on Yelp.
Oh, God.
It says 1 check-in, 2-star review. This is a very long 2-star review.
Well, they always are for food, but I never really put any thought into what it would be for non-food situations. But Dan, please close.
Christopher D. says this place is an institution. He says this place an institution.
Dan?
All right, I'm stopping.
Thank you.
This guy says his phone got sold.
Dan. Dan. I'm going to take your web browser away from you. Stop it. But back to this movie. They regroup. He regroups. He goes to the place in Compton, where I forgot her name.
Sharonda.
Where he has a place for her. She seems to have some problems. Taking care of herself and her surroundings.
I think it's probably heroin. If I had to guess, is her problem.
That could be the case, but he doesn't really seem to register that there's an issue, which is curious. But he calls Max Cherry and gets the assistant and then the beeper number and does the whole thing say that he knows that Pam's got it and he's gonna that Jackie's got it and he's gonna go after her unless. They give him the money, and sure enough, this is where Max Sherry uses Winston to find the location where Ordell is, and then he drives over there, and he's got the $1,000. The $10,000, the bond to return. And there's an exchange here where he gets conned into going back to the office and there's a phone call and Jackie's there in her suit and she answers and says all this stuff. And then she's checking the gun in the drawer and pulling it out and putting it back in. And there's extended driving shots. And she calls someone else and we just get the phone ringing before the cut. So
you're
obviously,
like, oh no, is whoever she's calling going to pick up in time to arrange whatever plan she has for what's happening here?
The answer is yes. And this is where she shouts, he's got a gun. And so Agent Nicolette shoots Ordell, who does technically have a gun on his person, but is not holding it.
You couldn't really tell. I mean, it lands on the ground next to him, but you couldn't really tell.
Yeah. It was unwise to sit in the dark for this. They kind of say, oh, well, got him now, and stuff. Case closed. And that's really interesting way of doing that. and we regroup with Jackie, and she's got her money, and she got it in the mail. Apparently he had mailed the money to her. It was the safest place to put it or whatever. And she's got a nice white blazer, and she's got Ordell's old car, which is creepy. But she's going to go, you
know, free car.
Well, she says, you ever borrow a friend's car? And it's like, not usually after they're dead. And
well, she's going to Spain. She's probably just going to leave it at the airport.
Madrid or Barcelona. And they have a little exchange about it. And she's like, I didn't use you. And, you know, you can come with me and all this other stuff. And he's like, I decided I'm going to be a bail bondsman. And this is after he had made the decision that he wasn't going to be a bail bondsman, because he was depressed that one time he broke in with a stun gun to wait for somebody to show up, and realized that life was too short and he really liked Pam Grier. And that suddenly changed again by the end of this film, where he's like, what am I doing? I'm just this guy. So he's back to being a bail bondsman.
He got a taste of the criminal life, and it was a little much for him.
Yes. Yes.
He's not hard enough to hang.
No, even though he is a stone fruit, technically, because a cherry has a hard pit.
I don't know why that's so funny.
I don't know. It's pretty stupid, Dan. but that is somehow a way that we have managed to summarize this entire film less time than it takes us to usually talk about anything.
Oh, God. We're very busy people living very busy lives, so I'm glad we were able to do that. A lot of good music in this movie, too. I believe the story was also, I feel like I heard this on a podcast or something somewhere. Because it's a super low-budget movie, and they had, like, I can't remember if they had a composer or they lost a composer, but they couldn't afford the score, basically.
They have James Newton Howard credited for the score.
Yeah, so basically what they did is they purchased the rights to use the score from Coffee, a Pam Grier movie from, I believe, the 70s, and they just reused that score basically wholesale.
It's inventive.
Yeah, I mean, it fit. It worked. It's Tarantino.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why James Newton Howard is involved in the credits then. Did they hire him and then produce a score and then reject it, or did they hire him and then go, oh crap, we can't afford the orchestra?
I feel like I wish I could remember where I heard this story, but it was something about they hired a composer, he had to bail the next person that came through or something, they couldn't afford, like, they basically ran out of money before they had this score completed. And the only thing that they had was, I don't even know if they paid for it or if they were, like, gifted the ability to use the Coffee score, but that's what they did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it fits.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to say, I've not seen a lot of Pam Grier films. I am shocked that she's not been in more things, I guess, that I would have seen.
She's been in a lot of things, just not recently.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason why she was cast in this is because Quentin Tarantino had an affection for the blaxploitation films of the 1970s, which she featured heavily in, and I believe Coffee is one of them.
Yeah. By the way, my fake doctor cousin in LA is going to have an absolute stroke when he listens to this, because I think he wrote his doctoral thesis on blaxploitation films, and it is a very subject very near and dear to his heart, and he loves this movie.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I've met him. Why? Mm-hmm. Why did he do this?
Well, he loves Quentin Tarantino, and he loves exploitation cinema from the 70s.
Oy.
Yeah, it's his thing.
Oy, Gewalt. Yeah. So it's interesting, and I like seeing her in this. And unfortunately, she didn't really get any awards or anything for this.
There was a note in the trivia that apparently this is like the one movie Tarantino never got any Oscar nominations for, and he was very upset that she didn't get a nomination for Best Actress.
Well, didn't Robert Forster get some nomination?
That is a good question. I say very slowly. He was nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah.
Look at that.
So that's not right. Maybe this is the only one where he didn't win anything, like even a technical category.
Pam and Sam were both nominated for Golden Globes. Pam was nominated for a SAG award. Yeah, I could see why it'd stick out a little bit if she didn't get nominated for the Oscar, but all these other ones.
Yeah, well, I'm just surprised she didn't, like, secure more stuff, because she is, quite frankly, stunning, and has an incredible screen presence.
Hmm.
When she's cool, calm, collected, and in control of a situation, like, I believe it. 100%. Like, her character is a flight attendant who, like, has theoretically no experience with the criminal underworld other than she's agreed to carry these packages. But for some reason, she becomes, like, this incredible mastermind by the end. And I'm like, I'm on board with all that. Like, that makes sense. She made me believe it. So I really like her character and performance here. And Forster's okay. I saw a lot of acclaim for him online when I was looking at the Wikipedia page earlier, and I was like, so all right.
Well, this is another sort of like revival in his career, in the same way Tarantino helped bring Travolta back with Pulp Fiction. This was a big thing for him, because he had kind of not done much before this for a while.
Yeah, but it was an okay performance. I didn't really love anything about it. He has the ability to be very like deadpan about everything and stoic.
Yeah. He's got good eyes in those extreme close-ups. He has the ability to wear his pants very high.
Oh my god, it's so high. When he sits on his desk at the,
at the end there,
it is the worst.
His like gut inside his pants.
Yeah, it's so ridiculous looking. If you are listener, if you are ever in the situation where you can watch this movie and nothing about what we've said so far compels you to have watched it, at least fast forward to the end so you can see the part where he has his pants hiked up like above the bottom of his rib cage and he's sitting on a desk. It is weird.
I wonder if he's just trying to do like a 70s thing here where it's like we're gonna put some very high pants on you.
So high.
How do you even find pants that go that high?
I don't
know.
That
much room in the crotch.
I mean, I'm sure they could go to a thrift store in the late 90s and find it. But yeah, it was odd. It was odd. But you know, I have to say that even that there were things that I liked about this, and I could see watching this in the way that Tarantino hinted at, in that quote that you had shared earlier before we started recording, you had said that Tarantino considers this a hangout movie. Like, there's just a bunch of characters hanging out, and you can just walk into the room and catch the movie, and they're just hanging out, and you can watch whatever it is, and they're just hanging out. And the more times you watch it, they're just hanging out more. Just like Rio Bravo. And I was like, okay.
What? I like that you said that like Tarantino. Just like Rio Bravo.
I mean, I don't necessarily buy his argument for that. But like, I could see like a scenario where if that was on television and I walked into a room, I would sit there and watch a little bit of it and then maybe walk off and do something else, because
yeah.
I'm not going to watch the entire thing again. But
in a very Tarantino way, it becomes kind of about those like quotes from the non-important scenes where they're sitting around BSing and Sam Jackson is likely monologuing. You know, you get your AK-47 quote. There are a couple other good quotes in here that people would say frequently, but yeah, it's about those moments that aren't necessarily plot, because once the plot gets going, there's not really a ton of dialogue in those scenes.
No, but I like the Del Amo Fashion Square Mall stuff.
Yeah, like, it's good. It's competent.
Yeah, I would just watch the Del Amo Fashion, whatever mall part, just that part. I like that part.
Well, I will take it as a personal victory that I recommended a Quentin Tarantino movie that you feel like you could watch a second time.
With the disclaimer.
No, don't hedge. Don't backtrack now.
No, it's not now. I very clearly disclaimed this earlier. I do not really feel compelled to revisit this movie in its entirety right now.
Sure, no, you can watch it in parts, bits and parts, but the fact that you would let these bits infect your brain a second time, I feel is a personal victory, because I don't know that there's been a single movie that I've ever recommended that you have liked that much, which is saying a lot, because you don't even like it that much.
If you want to read it that way, then
that's
you can.
That's how I want to read it, and that's all there is to it.
Okay, so I assume we'll be doing Out of Sight soon, and we will discuss the return of Michael Keaton.
The return of Agent Ray Nicolette. Let me ask you, how do you feel about George Clooney?
George Clooney doesn't always disappear into roles and sometimes comes off as George Clooney in lots of things, just being himself-ish, or just like that version of himself that you see on the silver screen.
Well, I guess here's the real question. Are you, in any context, susceptible to George Clooney's charm?
Oh, I am immune to George Clooney's charm.
Then... This may be an uphill battle for me then.
Oh, because you want to know why I'm immune to George Clooney's charm?
No, yes. Why?
Because I watch Batman and Robin. That's why.
And you haven't been able to get that out of your mind?
No. Every time I see him, he's always going to be a bad Batman. So
well I'm crossing my fingers that we can reposition him in your mind.
Sure. Maybe we can just watch Batman and Robin again.
Or not. We can watch good movies. Oh, I guess the other question is, how do you feel about Jennifer Lopez?
She had some good songs in the late 90s.
Well, are you aware that she has acted in things?
I am aware.
Uh-huh. Have you seen any of those things?
I was just highlighting.
Please don't say Made in Manhattan or The Wedding Planner.
I have not seen either of those.
Okay, good. You should watch The Wedding Planner. Not before Out of Sight, but you should watch that. You got McConaughey with blonde hair. It's something else. You get that Italian guy being very Italian. You get that other not Italian guy being very Italian.
I was really not expecting a full-throated endorsement for The Wedding Planner from you right now, but
you know, and the list of you're familiar with my penchant for watching very bad movies because I enjoy how bad they are. The Wedding Planner is one of those movies that's very bad in a very good way.
That's how I feel about 27 Dresses.
I disagree with that one, but I believe that they are very similar in their aesthetic.
And how to lose a guy in 10 days.
Oh, God, that might be the pinnacle of them, frankly.
All right, so, and anyway, until then, we'll just let's keep this podcast out of sight, shall we?
Cue across 110th Street again.
Of a fire, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, it never didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps try to catch a woman next week. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go free.